Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Over the past decade or so, the Japanese legend of a black samurai named Yasuke has become a ubiquitous part of Japanese popular culture. Today, there are manga, video games, and other media, including a feature film coming from Lionsgate, devoted to this black giant samurai from the 16th century who stood over a foot taller than the average Japanese man. My guest today, Thomas Lockley, has spent the better part of 10 years pursuing and telling the story of Yasuke in Japanese culture through scholarly papers and popular articles, and now, in conjunction with writer Jeffrey Gerard, he's written a novelistic telling of the story of Yasuke in their book, African Samurai, The True Story of Yasuke, a Legendary Black Warrior in Feudal Japan. The book combines European and Catholic accounts of the man, along with several key Japanese texts, to give readers the fullest understanding of this very mysterious man. The essential story is this. Yasuke came to Japan around 1578 as a bodyguard for a Jesuit missionary. Jesuits had a significant presence in Japan at the time. But within a year, Yasuke has joined the inner circle of the country's leading feudal leader, Oda Nobunaga, and was the only survivor of a coup within a couple of years that assassinated Nobunaga and his heir. Thomas Lockley is an associate professor at Nihon University College of Law in Tokyo. His book, African Samurai, not only tells the story of this black samurai, but also tells the story of feudal Japan and of all of the intricacies of Japanese culture at that time. It's a really interesting read. Thomas Lockley is my guest. Thomas Lockley, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've written a very interesting story in a novelistic way about this African samurai that shows up in Japan in the late 1500s, a Yasuke. How well known is Yasuke in Japan today?
Yasuke is quite well known in Japan today. He's been the subject of two computer games. He's been in numerous anime and manga comics. He's been in at least two books from the 60s and 70s. And he's made cameo appearances on television in the last 20 years. I think he's mainly become even better known within the last 10 years, and partly because of the work which I have done on researching his life. And in the last two or three years, he's been on television numerous times, kind of history detective programs, I think, finding out more about small characters in history.
So I'm guessing he was known as sort of a mythic figure, a Robin Hood in England, a Davy Crockett, a real person, but more thought of as a mythic figure as opposed to a real person.
I think he's always been thought of as a real person, but not enough has been known about him to use that necessarily in books or computer games or movies before. So therefore, when I have done this work to make his life more accessible and more open and more known to people, people have jumped on that to therefore do more work with it.
Now, how did you come to know the story of Yasuke?
Yeah, about 10 years ago, I just stumbled upon it on the internet. Thought, wow, this is quite some story. But at the time, all there was a list of sources, and maybe six sources about him, some which were European sources, some which were Japanese, and none of them which gave any particular conclusions or even much shape to his life. So it was about a year later that I actually decided, well, I've always wanted to write a book. Maybe this could be the book for me. And started looking at these sources in detail. What did the sources actually tell us? What more did we need to understand the sources fully and understand his life? And that work has taken me 9 years. Mm-hmm. I've also had, of course, the help of my excellent co-author, Jeffrey Gerard, in that.
Did you find more sources as you began investigating?
There were definitely more sources to find. Some of them were not necessarily about Yasuke. They were about other people that might have been Yasuke. We are not sure. I don't think we found any 100% new sources about Yasuke, but we did look so carefully at some of the older ones, got them retranslated or looked at the wording and found out, oh, well, actually, it means this. It didn't mean that after all. So we reinterpreted some of them as well as finding new sources which are about men like Yasuke that could have been Yasuke.
I was struck as I was reading. I said, you know, when I think about this time in Japan, it's a time of huge feudal wars. And, you know, feudal wars in the way European feudal wars were accomplished when, you know, a lord fell. It was not just the new lord would take over the lands and the army and the reigns. Oftentimes it was scorched earth. And so I was surprised that there were many contemporary accounts of Yasuke that survive this 500 years.
It's a good point. The most basic accounts we have are Jesuit missionary accounts. So the European accounts, they were sent back to Europe and forgotten about for 400 years. So they were surviving, or some of them were surviving, others were molding away in libraries in Europe. The Japanese accounts, the two that we have, one of them wasn't published until 1898. It had survived. It was a family diary. It survived in a castle somewhere. And the other one was a book which was published about 20 years after Yasuke disappears from history, maybe 25 years after Yasuke disappears from history. And it was printed, so there was lots of versions printed, and many of them survived into the modern age. They were printed after the end of the war, and therefore they survived through that.
So if you were explaining Yasuke to a person who had never heard of him before, how would you describe him?
Well, Yasuke was 6'2" in a world where most people were under 5 foot. He was a giant. He's described in the Japanese sources as having the strength of 10 men, which is often a euphemism for just extremely strong, but strong beyond what any other man around is like. He was described as being handsome, of having good demeanor, having good Japanese, and being able to make his lord laugh. And generally, he made his lord Nobunaga into a good friend. Nobunaga promoted him. He gave him a residence, a sword, which is the symbol of a samurai. He gave him servants, he gave him an income, and he had him by him as a bodyguard.
And this happened within the space of what, a year? A year and a half?
A year.
That's absolutely amazing. Was it the fact that he was African and Japanese had never seen Africans before? Was it the novelty of his size and his prowess as a warrior? What was it exactly that helped ingratiate him into what we usually think is a pretty closed society at this time?
Well, I'll start you off with their first meeting, and you can see from there how it went. Yasuke was the victim of a massive crowd in Kyoto who really wanted to get a look at him, get a touch of him. They thought he was some kind of divine being, as black skin was often depicted as a godly asset. So they thought he was some kind of god, and people were dying in the crowd to get him. And Nobunaga summons the person who's disturbing his peace. He sends his soldiers to disperse the crowd and summon whoever this person is. This person turns out to be Yasuke, the African samurai. And Nobunaga's he's so flabbergasted, he gets a sponge and starts to scrub at Yasuke's skin to see whether it's a joke, to see whether it's a PR stunt of some kind. Of course, Yasuke's pigment does not rub off. Nobunaga is astonished. Not only that, he's ecstatic. He throws a party. He calls his sons in. He calls other lords in, and they have a party, and Yasuke is the guest of honor. At the end of the party, he's gifted a massive amount of money, and then shortly after this, within the next few days, he becomes Nobunaga's man. Mm. And they go off to Nobunaga's castle together. I think the dates are not exactly clear, but within a month, he'd been given his residence, his sword, his income, his stipend. He'd become a samurai.
And he'd become a personal bodyguard to Oda Nobunaga, who was this warlord that was really on the verge of reuniting Japan at that particular time.
And he's possibly the most famous and or infamous person in Japanese history as well.
Now, if we take a step back from this story, how did he come to Japan in the first place? He came with the Jesuits, which this is a whole nother story in and of itself. You know, I think most Americans think of Japan as being fairly closed off from the world, especially from the Western world, until the 19th century. But in fact, the Jesuits had established missions in Nagasaki and some of the other eastern side of Japan, and had some relationships with the Japanese of that time.
And you have to remember also many of the Jesuits by Yasuke's time were actually Japanese. They were not only foreign Jesuits. Yeah. And there were Chinese Jesuits and Indian Jesuits by that time as well. But just to go back to the beginning, the first Jesuit missionaries arrived in 1549. That's exactly 30 years before Yasuke arrived. Within those 30 years, they had made around about 100,000 converts, including at least three or four very important lords, three of them in Kyushu and then one near the capital, near Kyoto. So they were pretty successful in spreading their faith. And Nobunaga was quite open. He was an atheist, essentially, but he was very open to new ideas, new concepts. He wasn't interested in the missionaries for their god. He was interested in them for their geography, their maths, the fact that they could bring interesting people like Yasuke to his court. They had a much wider reach than the Japanese did at the time. And because of the civil war during the time, international contacts had really kind of festered. There had been very good trading relationships with much of East Asia before that. But as war continued, the Chinese and the Koreans tended to stay away. It was a dangerous place to go. And the Japanese were too concentrated on fighting each other to worry about going and finding new lands and new trade opportunities. So the Jesuits came in on that with other Portuguese merchants and made most of it. And they made a fortune, the merchants, and the missionaries were very successful in spreading their word.
Now, this is how Yasuke basically came to Japan. He was actually the bodyguard for a Jesuit missionary, Alessandro Valignano, who I guess comes in late 1570s, somewhere around 1578. Do we have accounts of him mentioning Yasuke before?
Valignano never mentions Yasuke once in his writings. The Jesuit writings we have as evidence for Yasuke are from a man called Luis Froise and also from a couple of others as well, but mainly from Froise. Froise gives us at least three or four glances at this man, including about his character, including about the fact that the missionaries were quite fond of him, and also the fact of his promotion as well.
Apparently he'd been a slave at some point and been freed, correct?
Yeah, he was either freed or took his own freedom by escaping in India. Being enslaved in those days was not quite the same as the concept you might be thinking of it right now. If a master died, almost always all of the slaves were freed. If a slave soldier escaped a battlefield to live when his commander had died, he was a free man. I suspect that Yasuke was in the latter. He would have been a mercenary fighting in India and escaped from the battlefield, and there was nobody to tell him he was still a slave, and he just got on with his life.
The thinking was he was perhaps a Dinka tribe from Mozambique, from a Portuguese colony.
From South Sudan.
South Sudan.
There is a possibility that he was from the island of Mozambique, which was under Portuguese control at the time. But I think that's highly unlikely. I suspect he was more from what is now South Sudan.
Dinka is from that area, South Sudan and northern Kenya and all that area, right?
A little bit further north to that, near Ethiopia.
Ah, mm-hmm. And so we really don't know much about his life prior to his arrival in Japan, do we?
We don't know.
Yeah.
That part is all historical detective work. There are a few references back by Froise, for example, said the man that Valignano brought from the Indies. And that specifically means that he brought him from India. Doesn't mean that he wasn't African. He just happened to be in India when Valignano met him. So we know that that happened. The way I look back at there, I went to look at all the characteristics of the peoples of Africa and then combined them with the Japanese descriptions of what he looked like. So the Dinka are both very, very black-skinned, and the Japanese said that he had the color of ink, so black ink as mm-hmm. his skin. So he wasn't like the Mozambique, more kind of lighter brown-skinned. The Dinka are still, I think, the tallest people in the whole world on average. And so we looked at that too. They're also extremely strong. And also at this time, the slaving from the Dinka areas was just about starting and was far closer into the Arabic and the Indian slave trade than the Mozambique slave trade, which hadn't really got underway at that point. It was just on the cusp of starting. There's also face markings and teeth markings, distinctive face and teeth markings from different parts of where we thought he might have come from that he doesn't have. So we can also think about it in that way as well. I can't say for 100% that he was from South Sudan, a Dinka, but I would say I'm 80% sure.
My guest today is Thomas Lockley, the associate professor at the Nihon University College of Law in Tokyo. And he is the co-author of African Samurai, The True Story of Yesuke, a legendary black warrior in feudal Japan, the first black samurai. And it's a remarkable story of how quickly he became close to the seat of power in Japan at this time in the late 1570s and early 1580s. Now, you mentioned his first visit to Nobunaga, who was the warlord that ran a good part of Japan and was on the verge of practically uniting Japan. And you referred to the reception and how he became the guest of honor. He was not designed to be the guest of honor. Actually, it was Avellino, who was this Jesuit missionary who had come in. Allegedly, he was that was why he first showed up in Nobunaga's court in the first place, right?
Correct. Although Avellino wasn't supposed to be a guest, he was supposed to be a supplicant. He was going to Nobunaga to ask permission to leave Japan for a passport, if you like. And Nobunaga was going to give the permission to Valiano to both leave and for the mission to continue. So he wasn't exactly a guest. He was going to bow his, do a kowtow and give lots of gifts to ensure that his work would continue. Yesuke, on the other hand, was treated as a guest, a personal guest. And so the situation was slightly different.
Very quickly, the Jesuits saw him as a pathway to power. So they, instead of being a servant to them, he became a servant to Nobunaga, right?
Correct. We don't know whether he ever stayed in contact with the Jesuits. We don't know whether he ever helped them again. However, I mean, the proximity, geographical proximity of where Yesuke was living and where different missions were meant that they almost definitely would have at least talked to each other. I don't think that Yesuke would have been a spy as such, but he might have been a useful confidant for the missionaries if they wanted to just check something out.
But as you mentioned earlier, he very quickly was brought into this warlord's household as a very important person within the household as far as a bodyguard, a samurai, and confidant of the warlord. Do we have much accounts of how he lived his life? In the book, you have a number of episodes where there were feast days and a sumo tournament in which he was taking on three or four different opponents. But do we have much knowledge of what actually was going on within the Nobunaga court at this particular time when Yesuke was a part of it?
We do. We have a very, very good record of it because it was all written down in a book. That book was published about 25 years after Yesuke disappears from history. And so I know on a daily basis, or we know on a daily basis, what was going on in the court. What we don't know is exactly when Yesuke was involved in all of it, but we can hypothesize through looking at what activities he might have done. And there's also an extremely useful artwork which was published again a couple of decades after he disappears from history, which shows an African man sumo wrestling, a whole load of Japanese sumo wrestlers waiting in line to have a go, and Nobunaga adjudicating next door and with a big smile on his face. So we have some extremely good evidence for the fact that that happened.
Interesting. And at the time, Nobunaga is Literally, he is wiping out opposition to him, correct? Within the various feudal warlords.
Correct, and he didn't do it by halves. When he went to wipe something out, that was wiped out.
Did Yesuke play a big role? I mean, in the book, you sort of say he was pretty much very close to Nobunaga almost all the time, where maybe generals would go out and do most of the fighting. Do we have much evidence that he actually fought on behalf of Nobunaga?
During the three battles which happened while Yasuke was with Nobunaga, only one of them, Nobunaga, was on the front line. The other two, Nobunaga and with Yasuke with him, they were touring the defeated battlefield, so to speak. So they weren't necessarily there on the front line of battle as it happened. The third battle is the battle where Nobunaga dies. It is a coup d'etat. And Nobunaga he's got 30 men with him, including Yasuke, and he's attacked by 13,000 men. He's a rebel general, and, of course, it's a foregone conclusion. But Yasuke comes out as the hero at the end of the battle.
And Yasuke comes out, shows up at another battle down the road, the Battle of Okitanawate. This shows up a number of years later, correct?
Correct. If that one is Yasuke, there are questions as to whether it's the same man. But it's likely to have been the same man because he's referred to by the same source material, Louis Freuss, the missionary.
And in this case, he has moved from the service of the leading warlords to going back to the Jesuits at this point.
Well, Nobunaga dies, and Nobunaga's son dies as well. And therefore, there's nobody in control of the clan. The part here was hypothesis. We had to work out what the politics were going on at the time, and it was quite difficult to find a way of dealing with Yasuke because we know he didn't stay in Kyoto, the capital city, because he would have been noticed. There's no record of him there. So he must have been taken out of Kyoto, and he was last seen at the church, in the missionary church in Kyoto, and therefore the most likely thing is the missionaries took him to Nagasaki and then employed him there as a soldier, as they also needed soldiers, especially experienced soldiers down there, to defend their city of Nagasaki. Then when the Battle of Okitanawate comes, it would have been likely to send their general, if you like, to deal with the battlefield. They needed somebody who could deal with big guns. There's nobody in Japan who could deal with big guns at the time, cannon. And Yasuke was the man there to do that.
Mm. Now, the night that Nobunaga died, this was part of a coup d'etat by one of his most trusted generals. And his shogun lasted 13 days because the other generals, basically in warlords, rose up against him. But of all the people that died that night when Nobunaga died, Yasuke was the one survivor, correct?
He was the one survivor.
And you have to make a little bit of conjecture, but what is your conjecture of why he survived when everybody else was killed?
So he saved Nobunaga's head from being captured by the enemy. If the head had been captured by the enemy could literally have said, right, we've got the head, we're now in control, and it would have been a powerful tool of legitimacy for the coup d'etat. Yasuke was ordered to get out with the head and make sure it was safe. Therefore, the coup would find it much more difficult to succeed. Yasuke does his job. He takes the head to Nobunaga's heir, who's staying about 5 or 10 minutes walk down the road. So he jumps through gardens. He somehow gets through 13,000 troops and takes it to Nobutada, the son. Nobutada fights for about another hour or so, and Yasuke fights with him. At that point, the building they were fighting in burns down as well, and the head probably burns with it. We never find out what happens to the head. It's almost definitely burnt, along with many others. Again, Yasuke is one of the few survivors of that battle, probably through injury, and he is taken back to the Jesuits by the coup d'etat people, because the coup d'etat want the Jesuit support so that they can persuade other warlords to join them. In the end, the Jesuits don't give that support, but Yesquiere was a kind of present to the Jesuits to encourage them to do that.
Later, you describe what you feel like his role would have been with the Jesuit community, although there's not a lot of evidence of what he actually did. And then, of course, culminates with this Battle of Okatanawate, which is the last known of an African leading the forces in defense of the Jesuits and the allied warlords with them. And then he just disappears, correct?
Absolutely correct. The last portion of the book is finding different ways which he could have gone. There's, I think, about 5 to 10 ways which he could have gone. There are at least 2 or 3 sightings of people like him, one of which I'm convinced is him, though at this distance I have no conclusive evidence and probably never will. Another one who I'm 50 to 60% convinced is him. And, I'm afraid I can't go better than that. I've tried to be honest.
Right.
In the footnotes, you'll see the honesty coming out.
Yeah. No, and what's really interesting about this book, again, you have this novelistic telling of this story, but you really give us great insight into what life was like in the 16th century in feudal Japan within these warlord households, how the relationships between warlords worked. For me, it was a revelation. Was that another reason for telling this story?
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. I'd known a lot about Japanese history before I started on this project, so those kind of details weren't the revelation. But the actual nitty-gritty details, like how wives or daughters or sisters or brothers were sold off into other households to spy or to infiltrate other households, the whole massive politics of it, I think that did come as a bit of a surprise. It was such a dog-eat-dog world at that time.
And it really was. And it's very interesting. One of his generals does succeed in uniting Nobunaga's generals, one that remained loyal to him, basically did unite Japan within a few years and sent the Jesuits home, didn't he?
Absolutely. Hideyoshi, his name was.
Yep. Yeah. And that ended this, I guess, what Jesuits that were in Japan had to go into hiding, and those that were from outside of Japan had to leave.
Correct, yeah.
Was that the end of this era for a couple hundred years?
Not quite, because yeah. Hideyoshi died shortly after that, and then his laws became slightly more lax. And then you've got about 15 years later, then there's the definitive Jesuit expulsion order. They have to leave. They don't leave, they die. And it's enforced very strongly, and some do die because they haven't left.
Well, it is a really interesting story. The name of the book is African Samurai. Thomas Lockley, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed for having me. I hope you enjoy the book.
Thomas Lockley is an associate professor at Nihon University College of Law in Tokyo, one of the leading researchers into the life of the Black Samurai Yesquiere. He's co-author, along with Jeffrey Gerard, of African Samurai, The True Story of Yesquiere, a Legendary Black Warrior in Feudal Japan. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.